Welcome to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. Today, we'll continue our ongoing discussion of the climate crisis and, in this case, how Tampa Bay is preparing. I'd like you to join in as well. Here's the number if you want to get in the queue right now. It's 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. But first, here's a comment that was left by a listener after our last show. The program was about fracking and election integrity. It was also about transit in Hillsborough County. This listener took issue with a proposal by a transit advocate to remove I-275 from Malfunction Junction in Tampa northward and replace it with a multi-transit boulevard.
This is Jeff in Newport Richey, and in respect to the TB Next conversation that's going on, I have never heard such complete insanity in my life. The person who you had talking said that he's proposing, instead of making a left-hand turn, to go beyond and turn around and come back and make a right at the intersection where you wanted to make a left. Unless you're talking about a jug handle to the right, you're still talking about making a left across opposing traffic to come back to the intersection that you wanted to negotiate. That entire idea is insanity and needs to be scrapped. Thank you.
Well, that was a listener commenting about our last show. Later on in the broadcast, I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail. You can always listen to previous shows and comment on those stories on our website. You can join in the conversation on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram at WMNF News. Well, today on Midpoint, we look at the climate crisis and specifically how the Tampa Bay area is preparing. Or maybe it's more accurate to say how it's not doing enough for preparing. And you heard a little bit about this discussion in the last hour on Rob's show. In a major report last month, the Washington Post looked at this exact question, and we'll post a link to that story on our website, WMNF.org. The Post began, "Tampa Bay's coming storm. The area is due for a major hurricane, and it is not prepared. If a big one scores a direct hit, the damage would likely surpass Katrina." So that's quite a wake-up call. More than 1,200 people died in Hurricane Katrina. Parts of New Orleans were changed forever. Joining us in the studio for this hour is Melissa Baldwin. Melissa is the founder of Chase Media Services, a communications company that specializes in sustainability and climate change. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Melissa.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure.
I appreciate you coming in today. Thanks so much. So here's another quote from the article. "Tampa Bay is mesmerizing with 700 miles of shoreline, some of the finest white sand beaches in the nation, but analysts say the metropolitan area is the most vulnerable in the United States to flooding and damage. If a major hurricane ever scores a direct hit, a Boston firm that analyzes potential catastrophic damage reported that the region would lose $175 billion in a storm the size of Hurricane Katrina. A World Bank study called Tampa Bay one of the 10 most at-risk areas on the globe." Those are some huge numbers. Where we don't have that kind of money to just throw around. So it seems like the area should be prepared for a storm, but it's not. What's going on there?
So I found this article quite compelling, and I would really encourage your listeners to get online and view the article in Washington Post. There's some great interactive graphics on there. There's one chart where they have the hurricanes that kind of continually dodge Tampa Bay. They say it's like an epic game of dodgeball. And so, you know, I think it's really quite telling for an internationally recognized publication like the Washington Post to call out Tampa Bay for our vulnerability and for our lack of a response, for our lack of a plan. And what I really saw here was a failure of political leadership. I think that we need to see stronger leadership, certainly at the federal level, absolutely at the state level with our governor, and even in our local and region. So I'm excited to talk to you today about some things that your listeners can do, some local solutions and some state and regional solutions that we can work on to help us better prepare.
Well, good. I'm glad we're going to talk about some solutions. So we'll definitely get to those in the hour, but I do want to set this up a little bit more. See what the issue is that we're dealing with. And you mentioned that the Tampa Bay area hadn't gotten hit; it'd been missed and missed and missed. Hurricane Charley looked like it was coming here in 2004, and then it turned to the right.
Yeah.
And I just want to take a minor issue with something that the Post wrote that's kind of a little off subject, but it's, you know, I don't want people to get the wrong impression. It says, Tampa Bay is due for a major hurricane. And the fact that it's been missed for so many years does not make it more likely that there's going to be a hurricane. It's still the same probability that there will be a hurricane.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to make that point in case people thought, well, there's more likely there be a hurricane in Tampa Bay because it's been lucky for so long.
Yeah, you make a great point.
Tiny point, but and it's a little bit off the topic, but in case people have that impression.
I remember in 2004, I think it was Charlie that was coming and how alarmed everyone in Tampa Bay was. I remember the projections. It looked like it was going to go right over Tampa Bay. And I think even a lot of people evacuated from Tampa Bay to the south, which I think was unfortunate because, as I recall, it went over like, south of here. So, yeah, you're right about that.
Not to interrupt you, but it also, once it crossed inland, it went through Orlando, which is also inland. People thought, where's the safest place to evacuate from Tampa Bay? And they went to Orlando.
Right.
Which is, it hit very hard in Orlando. For years, you could drive down I-4 and see, you know, before you get to Disney, I think it is, you could see all the trees that were still down from Charlie.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Gene. That was an incredible year.
And none of them made a direct hit on Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay has not suffered a direct hit from a hurricane as powerful as a Category 3 or higher in nearly a century. And I'm reading again from the Post. Tampa has doubled down on a bet that another won't strike anytime soon, investing billions of dollars in high-rise condominiums along the waterfront, a shipping port upgrade, and expanding a hospital on an island in the bay to make it one of the largest in the state. There, they're referring to the Tampa General. Once sleepy St. Petersburg has gradually followed suit, adorning its downtown coast with high-rise condominiums, new shops, and hotels. And they go on to say that Pinellas County could be sliced in half by a wave of water. So either people don't know that there's the possibility of a storm that could hit the area and flood the downtowns of Tampa and St. Petersburg, and the beaches, of course. Or they're just taking that risk. And does it make sense to be building all this infrastructure and all this development right on the waterfront?
It's a really great question, Sean. I think that I love living here. I've lived here for over a dozen years, and this is a wonderful place to live. It's my home now. I love the beaches. I just spent the weekend at the beaches, and the development there, in terms of, you could see why people do it. I think even in the article, they talk about it, you know, yes, we know it's a risk, but we just love living here. It's so beautiful. And what I would say is that we are taking a risk, and that we need to be cognizant of that. Certainly insurance companies are absolutely starting to look at that. We saw a lot of major insurers, national insurers, pulling out of Florida, especially after 2004 and after Andrew a while ago. And so we have to look at, are we developing in a sustainable way and in a smart way? And are we being very thoughtful about how we developed and the plans that we have in place, given that we know that a certain amount of sea level rise is inevitable? And one of the other things that I want to talk about, and I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but you're dealing with a couple of different factors here. We're talking about our risk. We are at risk to extreme weather. Downpours can inundate our sewers and all of that. We have flooding. But we also have risk from storm surge, which is a big part of the hurricane risk. And that is amplified. And this is something that I learned just recently, is that the West Coast is actually more vulnerable to the East than the East Coast of Florida, because we have shallower oceans and shallower seas. So the storm surge is able to grow more intensely and be a higher storm surge on the West Coast. And I think that's in part why the Washington Post looked at Tampa Bay and looked at our area, because the way the water pushes into the coastline, into the bay there, it can really get pretty high, and that is a huge risk.
And another thing is, if you have a straight coastline, like picture, I don't know, maybe like, you know, from the East Coast, from Cape Canaveral down to almost Miami, where it's just essentially a straight coast. Now you've got barrier islands. You're pushing all the water against a flat coast, whereas if in Tampa Bay, it's like a funnel. You're pushing a wall of water into a funnel, and it all funnels toward Upper Tampa Bay and the, you know, city of Tampa. Mm-hmm. And so for hours and hours, the waves and the wind could be pushing all that water into Tampa Bay. And I think, I mean, I'm not an oceanographer in the sense of a physical oceanographer, but I think that the amount of waves that would be could be pushed over hours and hours and hours would make the storm surge in Tampa more severe than it would be maybe in some place where there's not a bay that funnels all that water.
Absolutely. That's right. That's exactly, yeah. And so, again, so we have the risk from storm surge. We have the risk from more extreme, intense downpours, all related to climate change. And then we have the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that is sea level rise. And one of the things that I like to talk to people about is the connection between Florida and the Arctic. And it's easy to think the Arctic is some far-off place. It doesn't really affect us. But the fate of Florida is related to the fate of the Arctic. The fate of Greenland is the fate of Miami and Tampa Bay, because the amount of sea level rise is directly related to the amount of ice melt that we see in the glaciers in Antarctica and in the Arctic.
Yeah, well, maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Let's back up and talk about why we're even looking, why are we even concerned about sea level rise? What, you know, where is sea level rise ultimately coming from in regards to global warming? I mean, you have two main factors. One is that the warmer water takes up more space. It has a larger volume. And the other is, as you mentioned, the ice is melting in the Arctic, and so there's more water in the ocean.
Yeah, I can elaborate on that. You got that right, Sean. So there's a couple of different things that are contributing to sea level rise. About a third of the sea level rise that we've seen from the period from 2004 to 2010 is from thermal expansion. And that is essentially when water gets warmer, it expands. And so you see a larger volume of water. So about a third of the sea level rise that we've seen is from that expansion. About another third is from the Arctic. So it's from melting ice in the Arctic and Greenland and Canadian Arctic glaciers. So those are two of the major contributors. The rest of the contributions come from Antarctica and other glaciers. So they contribute about less than a third. So that's where it's coming from. So it's coming from different places.
Well, our guest is Melissa Baldwin. She's the founder of Chase Media Services. And we're going to go to the phone lines. We have Bob on the line. Hi, Bob. What would you like to ask?
I'm just saying, I've been living in the Tampa Bay area since 1980. And they seem to have gotten a lot more damage over on the other coast than we've ever gotten here from any hurricanes. I got friends and relatives that live over in Melbourne, and they shut down that whole coast from that one storm that came through there. I don't know when the last one that came through, but it closed up every one of those big hotels, and they're not building any more hotels down there now. Try to get a hotel down on Melbourne Beach or along the coast there. There's nothing there really anymore. The old ones are still there, and they're not building any new ones. And their insurance over there, their flood insurance and their homeowners insurance is cheaper than what we're paying over here, which is kind of odd because they've been getting hit more, and we haven't been hit in a long time, knock on wood. You know, I own a house here too. But the idea of the whole thing is, well, the last words I got to say about this is those insurance companies had been ready to write some big checks, because we've all been paying a lot of money for a lot of years and not collected a dime. Because everybody's got at least a $2,000 or $5,000 deductible on their insurance. So you don't make any claims. Any little thing that happens to your house, you more or less take care of it yourself. So they just had been, they're making billions and billions of dollars off us. They have the money to reconstruct everything that could ever happen here. So that's why we have insurance. I mean, that's the whole deal behind it. That's why we live here. We have insurance. Up north, I'm from Wisconsin, and up north in Wisconsin, their homeowner's insurance, my mother's homeowner insurance before she passed away was, I think it was like $300 a year, maybe. And then down in Missouri, you get there and you get in Kansas, they get tornadoes, and their homeowner's insurance is cheap too, and they're constantly getting hit there. So that's what I got to say.
All right, Bob, thanks for that call. And I you know, insurance companies have reinsurance, so they would hopefully be able to pay out even if there was a major storm, because they're insured and they have been collecting all this money, as you've been saying. But it is possible that there could be such a huge storm that does so much financial damage in addition to the human price that it would be, you know, be real hard for even for the insurance companies and the reinsurance industry to make up their losses. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would say you hit the nail on the head in terms of the reinsurance industry. What we've seen internationally is that reinsurers are absolutely paying attention to climate change. They're paying attention to extreme weather events, and they're mitigating their risk. They're looking at ways to not only, you know, pull out of high-risk areas, but also being a part of the conversation about reducing. What did they say? When you're stuck in a hole, the first thing you need to do is stop digging, right? So they're looking at how can we actively reduce the pollution that's causing some of these problems with climate change. And the other thing I wanted to say, you talked about the insurance companies. I wanted to point out just before us on the show before this with Rob Laurie, I believe it was Mike Fasano who was talking about, he had some concerns about some of the newer insurance companies that have taken a lot of policies out of Florida's Citizen, which is supposed to be the insurer of last resort. And there are some people who have expressed concerns about the ability of some of those companies to handle a huge storm and what would happen there.
And yeah, so that's one of the things that Citizens was supposed to do, is be able to cover people when they weren't really coverable. And then now that we're taking so many people out of Citizens, it makes you wonder whether that's even something that's going to happen. If you'd like to join the conversation, 813-239-9663. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. We're talking about climate change and the climate risks that Tampa Bay faces. It's 12:22 in the afternoon, and my guest is Melissa Baldwin. She's the founder of Chase Media Services. So sea level rise, why don't we just back up even one more step and get to pumping carbon into the air, because you were talking about how the reinsurance companies want to stop the digging. How is carbon pollution, how does that eventually get to sea level rise?
So this gets to the essential issue of what is climate change, what is global warming, how does this all work? So there's a really short saying that I like to say, and that is, it's warming, it's us, we're sure. It's bad, and we can fix it. Humans are putting about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which is a heat-trapping gas, into our atmosphere every single year. If you look back at the rise of human civilization, going back 400,000 years or more, we have had relatively stable levels of atmospheric carbon levels, being between about 180 and 280 parts per million. We know this because we can measure this. We can do ice core samples in the Arctic, and we can measure the parts per million of carbon dioxide going back thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. There are many other ways of measuring this. We have multiple lines of evidence that show us that the amount of carbon dioxide, the concentration in our atmosphere, is going up. And so human civilization, we've developed over this relatively stable climate where we've been between 180 and 280 parts per million. And do you know what the levels are today?
Well, it's crossed 400.
Yeah, over 400. Yeah. Right. So we're running a giant global experiment on our planet. And I'll remember, one of the reasons that I got so passionate about climate change is because I had a professor in college. It was 1999. It was at Bowling Green State University. And I had a professor who really changed my life when he talked about climate change. And what he did is he walked into the classroom and he drew a giant line across the chalkboard. This was before smart boards. He drew a giant line and he asked, what is the hottest temperature known to man? Not everybody knew. It was the temperature of the sun. And he asked, what is the coldest temperature known to man? And it's like absolute zero, negative 459 Kelvin. It's some very cold temperature. He said, what is the temperature of liquid water? And it's 32 degrees Fahrenheit to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that is the range of life on Earth, right? Life on Earth is possible in part because we have liquid water. And he drew two tiny little hash marks at the very center of the room. You could barely even see them. And he said, this is the range of life on Earth that we have in this very small window. And he said, in reality, if this chart was to scale, the temperature of the sun would be out through the parking lot on both sides. So we have this very small window that enables life on Earth, and we are messing with that thermostat. Human beings are changing the atmospheric concentration that enables life on Earth. And so that really got my attention. That combined with the idea that there was a concentrated effort on behalf of certain, in many cases, fossil fuel industries to mislead and confuse the public and to create that doubt. All they had to do is create just a little bit of doubt, and just that doubt is enough in many cases, and we're seeing this still today, to lose that political will that we need to have to face this problem. And so I hope that explains to some degree why I'm passionate about this issue. I hope it encourages others to be passionate about this issue. We really do have life on Earth is absolutely a miracle, and it's something that we need to preserve and protect.
813-239-9663. We've got a full bank of phones, so let's get a couple of calls on the air. Bob in Tarpon Springs, what would you like to say?
Hi, I'd like to talk about the article about Tempe being most vulnerable to hurricanes. I read that, and I thought it was quite a bit alarmist, considering that we haven't been hit directly since, I think, the 20s. And since then, there are building codes that say if you want to build near the water or on the water, you can't build ground level. You have to build up. There are certain things being done. And in my lifetime, I've lived here all my life. I'm in my mid-50s. The worst flooding we've had were not related to hurricanes. It was 1979. Due to rain, when the entire north end of Tampa and most water, some of it for 6-8 months, almost a year before they changed the way things drain, and then the March storm in the 90s. Neither one were hurricanes, and those two did more damage than any of the hurricanes since the 20s.
And that would not be the case if a hurricane did hit. I mean, it's true that Tampa Bay has been lucky that it hasn't gotten a direct hit from a major hurricane.
Right. And it's, being prepared for a hurricane is like being prepared for an atomic bomb. What can you do? You can't build a giant wall to keep the water out. You can't keep the wind out. There's preparations that you can do. But, you see it on the news. Every time there's a hurricane warning, it's going to be the end of the world, where, historically it hasn't been on this coast, and it hasn't been for the Tampa Bay area.
I hear your point, Bob, and I hear what you're saying. I think that that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be prepared, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have these hard conversations and really taking a serious look at the way that we've developed, whether or not we've developed sustainability, and what is our plan? What is our, around when hurricane seasons, you always hear all of that warnings or get your plan. And so I think the same applies to not just individuals, but how are we as a region getting prepared for not just the extreme storms and the sea level rise, the storm surge, but also the sea level rise and more extreme and intense weather that we're facing because of climate change.
Right. Well, that's a separate issue. I mean, it's related, but that really is a separate issue when talking about hurricane preparedness, which is what the Washington Post article basically was about.
All right. Thanks so much for your thoughts, Bob. I appreciate that. 813-239-9663 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let me read this email from John before we go back to the phones. John says, thanks for the show. Two questions. What happens if the insurance companies cannot cover the cost of a hurricane, including the reinsurance companies? And he says, and John from Port Richey says, one of the arguments I have heard against human activities having an impact on global warming is that the Earth has gone through heating and cooling periods in the past. So I'd like to know if there's any evidence that natural causes are responsible for these cycles of the past.
Sure. I would encourage you to visit skepticalscience.com, where they have a very detailed outline of every single argument against it not being caused by man. Specifically, they go into, and if you're saying it's natural cycles, I would ask you, which natural cycle is it? Because we've looked at all of them. We've looked at the orbit of the Earth around the sun. We've looked at volcanoes. We've looked at all of these things. None of these things explain the warming that we've seen. However, carbon dioxide perfectly lines up and matches the warming that we've seen. The graphs, there are multiple lines of evidence that this is not natural causes, that this is indeed caused by man. And the other argument I would make is that, what do you have to say about the carbon that we're putting in the atmosphere? We know we're doing that. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere is like your height or your weight. It's a measurement. You can't dispute it. So the amount of carbon in the atmosphere has changed. The other thing is that there is actually an isotope. There's a carbon isotope, so we can tell the difference between naturally occurring carbon and carbon that is created by fossil fuels by man. And we can measure that difference, and we see that the extra carbon that we see in the atmosphere is from, it has that human fingerprint on it.
And the natural cycles are always occurring and are still occurring, whatever. There are cycles, but you're talking about cycles within, you're essentially, you're moving the bell curve. The bell curve has been shifted to the hotter end, and the little variations, the smaller variations that are due to natural are happening all the time within that bell curve, but everything has been shifted toward the hotter end.
Mm-hmm. 813-239-9663.
And John's first question has to do with if the reinsurers couldn't afford it, it would probably fall on the government.
So Florida has something called a catastrophe fund. And I remember back in 2004 through 2006, and we had Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Gene, and we had those, we really got walloped. And there was an effort on behalf of a lot of the insurance companies to look at what would be called a national catastrophe fund. And essentially what that would do, and so when, this is my understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, so I would encourage you to continue researching it. But my understanding is that there is something called a catastrophe fund where if for whatever reason insurer cannot meet, or they're able to tap into that fund and everybody is contributing to that fund. In fact, I think you might even be able to see the assessment on your insurance bill. So there is that. In terms of what else could be done, that's a great question. I don't know. You know, I think that that's something we need to continue to discuss and I believe that our legislature is looking at that as well.
So I'm going to ask a politically touchy subject. Most of the houses that would suffer the most financial damage are people who live right on the water and people with the most expensive homes. So is a national catastrophe fund, is that essentially the poor or the rest of us, all of us, supplementing the rich so that they can live in their million-dollar mansions on the beach, or I guess it would be like $2 or $3 million mansions on the beach, and then when the big one comes, we've essentially got to pay them for their house.
Are we subsidizing that? Right.
I
think we need to have a serious and honest discussion about that, and I don't know the answer. You know, I think that we all have to take a look at, you know. And the other thing that actually what you started to talk about, Sean, that reminded me of another point, and that is environmental justice. You make a great point that there are a lot of wealthy million-dollar mansions on the coastline, but there's also a lot of people who are at risk who are not necessarily huge contributors to the problem, and that's the environmental and climate justice issue. In Florida, there's an organization called Organize Now that's doing a lot of good environmental justice work where we're looking at the people who are going to suffer the worst consequences of climate change, the people who can't afford to necessarily move. Like in that Washington Post article, they discussed that lady who lives in the trailer home where it regularly floods. She doesn't necessarily have the means to be able to move. And so that's an environmental justice issue where we have to look at, are the people who are contributing to this problem, are they going to suffer the worst consequences, or who, you know, and how can we create a fair and equitable way, not only in terms of, you know, suffering the consequences of climate change, but also in terms of implementing the solutions. So you look at some of the solutions like solar panels, electric cars, how can we make those more affordable for everybody and not just those who have the means to afford it?
And speaking of means to afford it, let's talk about the most expensive development in the Tampa Bay area. We have the what's being called now the Water Street Tampa development. It's a $3 billion project that's planned for downtown Tampa. Of course, downtown Tampa is right on the waterfront. And the development is headed by Lightning owner Jeff Vinnick. And it's funded by Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates' investment fund and will also get some funds from the Tampa taxpayers. And I want to play you this sound. About 2 years ago, I asked Jeff Vinnick if it was wise to build right at sea level in downtown Tampa. And here's my question, and here's how Jeff Vinnick answered it.
Mr. Vinnick, you're making a lot of investment on the waterfront in Tampa. How concerned are you about sea level rise and global
warming? Fortunately, we think about that, and if you look at the details surrounding our whole plan and the logistics behind it, all of our buildings are going to be built at a high enough level to withstand quite a severe storm that may hit. When you look at the sea level studies, I think there is a wide range of opinion about how things are going to change over the next 50 to 100 years. You know, I'm very confident that this area where we're at can be a great district and a terrific part of the Tampa Bay area for a long, long time to come.
Do you have a number of feet that you're okay with? Like if there's a storm surge of 20 feet?
You're beyond, if I answer that question, we'd be in trouble because you're beyond my level of expertise on that one.
Well, that's Jeff Finnick. I asked him about 2 years ago how vulnerable it was to sea level rise and to storm surge. And Melissa, our guest is Melissa Baldwin. How do you feel about that response about the most expensive development project right there on the water in Tampa?
So I would look to leaders, both business leaders and political leaders, I would encourage them to have an eye for sustainability. I know that one of the things that Vinick wants to do with that development is attract millennials. And I'm just barely a millennial. I just made the cut. And I think that the millennial generation cares a lot about corporate social responsibility and cares a lot about intention and sustainable development. So I would encourage leaders like Vinick and our political leaders to get serious about making a commitment to develop sustainably and responsibly and take a serious look at the risks. I mean, I'm sure that there's a risk assessment that's being done in all business transactions. And so are we accurately looking at the very real risk of climate change and sea level rise? And I wanted to point out there's the South Florida Regional Climate Change Compact did an estimate in 2015 of sea level rise, and they are expecting 6 to 10 inches by 2030. And 14 to 26 inches by 2060. And the common thing that you hear is about 2 feet by 2060. So that's significant, you know, if you consider where a lot of our buildings are. And going back to the point of the earlier caller, he mentioned that we talk about now how new building codes require things to be built of a sea level rise, but what about the things that were built in, you know, in 1940, 1950, 1960, before those codes, they're still there. So again, these are all risks that I think we need to have a serious conversation about. And, you know, in South Florida, they actually have a regional climate change compact where there's counties that are working together, Broward, Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach counties, and they're all working together to address mitigation and adaptation. Adaptation is dealing with the sea level rise that's already in the pipeline, no matter what we do, and mitigation is taking action now to reduce carbon emissions so that we avoid the worst consequences of sea level rise. And so you see in South Florida, they've actually been internationally recognized for some of the work they're doing to address this. And what we need is to have that leadership here in Tampa Bay. Why can't we have a West Coast Climate Compact where we have counties working together, Pinellas, Hillsborough, even parts of Sarasota? Why can't we work together to evaluate these risks and develop a plan for them?
And we're going to go to Chris in St. Petersburg in just a minute. I have you on the line, and I'm going to put you on just a second. But I do want to ask, Melissa, one of the red flags that I heard in that answer, and maybe I have it misplaced, but when I hear someone say, oh, well, there's a wide range of opinion about sea level rise, on one hand, that's completely true. In all scientific hypotheses, I guess, you're going to get a range, right? But when a denier is doing their best at denying, they say, oh, well, there's a range and we don't know exactly and that. So that was a kind of a red flag for me when he said, well, there's a wide range of opinion of sea level rise. And you just mentioned a range. You said, well, it could be 2 feet or it could by 2060 or whatever. We don't know exactly. There's no way to know exactly. It could, you know, a chunk could fall off of Greenland tomorrow or the Antarctic tomorrow, and it could raise things more than we anticipated, or it could happen in 100 years and we just don't know. Should it be a flag? Should it be a red flag when someone says, well, we don't know, and then they go on as if it's not something to worry about? That's what I was concerned about.
Yeah, wouldn't they say you like expect the worst or hope for the best and expect the worst, plan for the worst? Yeah.
Like what
yeah.
the Dolly did. The mm-hmm. Dolly was the museum
right.
in St. Petersburg. They pointed that out in the Washington Post article that you could watch a hurricane come. You could sit up in the glass dome of the Dolly and watch the hurricane come ashore as if you were watching it on the Weather Channel because they built it to withstand a hurricane. Mm-hmm. And that's not what I heard about from Vinick's development. Now, I can't build every building like that, of course, but it I don't know. I just didn't get very much confidence from his answer. I'm saying that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's go now to Chris in St. Petersburg. Hi, Chris. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, hi, Mitch.
It's Sean.
I'm sorry, Sean. I'm just from listening to you both online and now since you said you were going to take my call, now that you said you're going to take it, in that between that time, you were very faint. So so I didn't catch anything you had to say. That's why I just tuned in on the radio. I guess I'll have to go back and listen to the archives to catch that. I have plenty to say, though. What I call to mention is that the ice core samples show that carbon dioxide increases up to 800 years or even more after the temperature increases. So that means that even if we were to assume that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, then that shows that orbital variations and especially the sun are the prime drivers. And the most recent warming periods were the Roman warming period and the medieval warming period, where it was much warmer than now. And since CO2 is a needed plant nutrient, then food production was increased, and that might have accounted for the Renaissance and increase in technology. Even if we were to assume CO2 is a greenhouse gas, we have other alleged greenhouse gases, according to the EPA's website, that for some reason, even though they have greater impact, are never mentioned. You never hear of our fluorinated gas footprint, which is the most impactful. The EPA's website does not mention water vapor as the most impactful otherwise greenhouse gas. It does, though, mention methane, nitrous oxide, and carbon dioxide, just briefly, has a global warming potential of 1. Fluorinated gases have a global warming potential in the thousands of to tens of thousands, according to the EPA's website.
So I'm gonna just cut you off right there, just to say that, I mean, the amount of those fluorinated gases that are produced by humans every year is microscopic compared to the amount of CO2. So that's probably why, yes, an individual molecule of that gas has a greater potential, just like methane does, but we produce so much more CO2. So I think that's why that anomaly you're talking about is, that's why it's not mentioned. It just doesn't contribute as much overall as carbon dioxide, which contributes quite a bit. Now, getting to John's point, and I had a caller a couple of years ago on a show who also said, and it may have even been John, but this caller also said that that CO2 emissions get higher, that lags the temperature increase. And so it's essentially, that person was postulating that temperature increases cause CO2 warming. And that's just, all right, I'm going to back up. He mentioned the Renaissance. But CO2 levels are so far beyond what they were in the Renaissance. I mean, you just can't, historically, the only time this is comparable was like during the Jurassic or something, right? When or even before that, I don't know that much about it, but the 400 parts per million of CO2 was not during the, you know, Renaissance, and the temperature extremes are not going to be like during the changes from the last ice age to after the last ice age. We're talking about doubling of CO2 than it's been ever been historically while there were humans on the earth.
So I would just say I have to respectfully disagree with you. I'm going to listen to what all the scientists are telling me, and 98% of the scientists are saying that the earth is warming, that it's caused by carbon dioxide, that it's caused by man's contribution, and that's unequivocal. And scientists are very, and I work with scientists, I have a lot of respect for them, they are very conservative. They are very cautious. They absolutely did all of the research, and peer-reviewed evidence shows, you cannot find a peer-reviewed evidence that shows the points that you're making about. And the other thing I'll say is that, what if you're wrong? So the solutions that I'm advocating for are clean energy, reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, producing energy domestically, using the sun in Florida, the Sunshine State, reducing pollution. One of the solutions I want to talk about today is the carbon fee and dividend, and that places a fee on fossil fuels, and it returns the revenue to individuals, to households. And so doing that would reduce emissions by 30% in 10 years and 50% in 20 years. It would create 2.1 million jobs within 10 years. It would create 2.8 million jobs in 20 years. It would grow our GDP by $70 to $85 billion per year. And it will, in 20 years, it'll grow our GDP by $1.37 trillion, and it will save 227,000 lives.
So that's it. That's if the United States institutes a carbon fee and
that's
dividend?
That's a carbon fee and dividend, which is a policy I can talk more about. So, and the other thing I like to say is that, you know, my daughter, she's 2 years old. She's going to be 45 in 2060 when sea levels rise 2 feet. I want to be able to look my children in the face and tell them I did everything in my power to make a difference, to stand up for what I know, what I believe in. And I would say that if you want to continue to deny this, I think that you should be willing to tell your grandchildren that. Be willing to have it written on your gravestone so that they know when you're gone that you stood in the way of progress.
Our guest is Melissa Baldwin, founder of the Chase Media Services, and my name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. It's 12:45 in the afternoon. We have about 15 minutes left in the show, and you can call in 813-239-9663. And you can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. I want to go back to the phones in just a second, but let's talk a little bit more about the carbon fee and dividends. So if you produce carbon, you pay a fee, which would make everything more expensive, right? But what's the dividend part?
So I find this really interesting. And so the Citizens Climate Lobby is a quickly growing nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. It's international. It's average everyday people who care about this issue and who want to make a difference. And so the solution that they're advocating for is a federal solution. And I hope we get to talk about local solutions too, because I think that's important. But the carbon fee and dividend would place a fee on fossil fuels at the source, so at the mine, the well, or the port. It would return all of the revenue to households equally. And there would be a border adjustment on goods from other countries that don't have a price on carbon, so we deal with that. And again, it goes through all those impacts that I discussed. The average household will receive about $288 per month in 10 years. So this is the fee and dividend policy. It promotes economic growth. It's a free market approach. There's no regulation in it. It's revenue neutral. It's predictable. It's going to reduce carbon dioxide. It's going to save lives. And what I think is cool about this, and what's cool about the Citizens Climate Lobby, is that they have created a bipartisan climate solutions caucus. And so bipartisan meaning that in order for another member of Congress to join, the R has to have a D to go with them. So if a Democrat wants to join, they have to find a Republican. The same thing for Republican and Democrat. It was actually started by two Florida lawmakers, Curbelo down in South Florida and Ileana Ross-Layton. So the good news is that it's growing all the time. Right now, there are 48 members. So I would say if you want to take action on climate change, if you are concerned and you do think this is an issue, I would encourage you here locally, we could contact Representative Kathy Castor or Representative Vern Buchanan. Kathy Castor has been a champion of the environment for a long time. And she just needs to hear from more people about this solution. And I'm actually pleased to say that Vern Buchanan is my own representative. He's a Republican, but I've seen really encouraging things from him on climate change recently. Specifically, in July 13th, he voted. The House voted on a bill to strip climate change language out of the National Defense Authorization Act, and the House voted no. So that was a big win for the environment and for the climate communities. The good news is that Vern Buchanan voted the right way on that bill. So I do see some progress there and some reasons to be hopeful, and that is at the federal level. And in case you're wondering, I know politics can get sticky, but I would point out that policy has a huge ability to make an impact. So if you have any doubt about that, just Google the border between the Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and you can see a satellite image of a country that has strong environmental policy and a country that doesn't. And you can see all the deforestation in Haiti, and you can see in the DR that there's still lush forest. So policy absolutely has an impact.
You know, when you mentioned the Republican members of that bipartisan committee that were from South Florida, for some reason the no one's an atheist in the foxhole saying came up, because I mean, I guess if you're previously a climate denier but you live in South Florida, your eyes have to be opened, I think.
Yeah, we're just absolutely seeing leadership, especially from South Florida lawmakers.
And I'm not advocating any for or minus religion. It was just the saying crept into my mind when you said that. Let's talk about, so since we're talking about politics, let's go completely political to a man who's running for governor. Here, first I'm going to read what we know about what Rick Scott's administration has done. And this is again from that Washington Post story, which we'll post to on our website, wmnf.org. State leaders could be part of the reason for no inaction on climate change. Republican Governor Rick Scott's administration has reportedly discouraged employees from using the words climate change in official communications. Last month, this would be June, the Republican-controlled state legislature approved bills allowing any citizen to challenge textbooks and instructional materials, including those that teach the science of evolution and global warming. And so now I'm going to bring in my interview with Adam Putnam, who is running for governor. And the day he announced in Bartow, this was in May, I asked him about carbon pollution and what the role of Florida's governor would be if he became governor. So here's Adam Putnam's response.
If you're Florida governor, what do you think the Florida governor should do about reducing carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, certainly any policy of that size should be federal in nature so that we don't put Florida jobs at risk vis-a-vis other states and other countries. I'm focused on making Florida the launch pad for the American dream. We can be the magnet for talent from all over for people to raise their families here, start their businesses here, and grow their businesses here. And that is the focus that any governor should make their number one priority.
So if the federal government does nothing, you're okay with that?
Let's see what the federal government does.
Well, that's Adam Putnam. And since that time, here's what the federal government has done. Donald Trump has pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. So do you think it's a wise idea for the state of Florida and potentially the next leader of the state of Florida to just sit back when it comes to carbon pollution and just wait and see what Donald Trump does?
No, I absolutely do not. I think that we need leaders who are ready to tackle this difficult, and it is a political problem, but it can create jobs. He talked about creating jobs and making Florida a beacon for families to come and live in Florida and raise their families here. Clean energy is absolutely a job creator. You know, clean air is absolutely a desirable thing. And so in having a safe, livable community where you've evaluated your risk and you had a thoughtful, conversation about that, I think those things can happen together. I do not think that solving the climate crisis is going to damage our economy. I think it's going to help our economy. And in fact, I would go back to another part of the of that article from the Washington Post, where they talked about, it says that Risky Business did some research. They said the value of state property that will vanish under encroaching water could reach $15 billion, and by 2050, it could reach $23 billion. So we absolutely need political leaders who are willing to take this on to address this. And I would say that it was very disappointing when President Trump withdrew us from Paris. However, there are local cities, mayors that are taking action. So there can always be progress. You know, when one door closes, another window opens. And so, I'm very encouraged by campaigns like the Sierra Club's Ready for 100, where we see really great progress where local cities, citizens are embracing the Ready for 100, which is a campaign to move to 100% clean renewable energy.
St. Petersburg was one of the very first cities in Florida, if not the whole Southeast, to join the Ready for 100. That means that by a certain date or by an uncertain date, there will be 100% renewable energy will be the energy source of the city. Other cities nearby have also joined. So,
Orlando City Council will vote this Tuesday on a resolution to commit to 100% clean energy. On June 25th, Melbourne City Council voted to create a sustainability board. And as you mentioned, in St. Pete, the City Council funded, they're doing good work there. So we would like to see more leadership here in Tampa from Mayor Bob Buckhorn. We'd like to see him really embrace this and embrace clean energy. But there certainly are, really encouraging signs that we're seeing in cities all over in terms of embracing clean energy.
My guest is Melissa Baldwin. She's the founder of Chase Media Services. I'm Sean Canaan, the host of Midpoint Monday. It's 12:54 in the afternoon on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. Ernest in Temple Terrace, you're on the air. What would you like to say?
Well, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Hi.
All right. Here we go. If you remember back to that hurricane, right? It was messed up. The hurricanes came in, and then they were killing everybody. Go inland, go inland, go inland. So I guess the hurricane saw everybody go inland and said, well, I'll go too. So it turned and went inland. Then they were telling people, hunker down because it is stuck. You talk about people with boats, planes, everything. And then when that was all done, by the way, one of my friends, her friend was killed when the building collapsed up there in Orlando. And then after that, I remember businesses, insurance companies actually trying to leave the state of Florida without paying anything. And jump over to the Florida and the job businesses, they already got it. All you got to have is no unions, low wages, no impact fee, business will come. But the thing is, it won't benefit nobody in Florida. It'll benefit the politicians. And that's it. Bye.
Great. Thank you, Ernest. Thanks for that call. 813-239-9663 if you'd like to call in. We're going to go to Les in just a minute, but let me read an email or two. Let me see what James has to say about, Jim, rather, in St. Pete has to say about the Dolly. He says, the Dolly Museum could withstand a direct hit from a hurricane, huh? And the Titanic was unsinkable, too. Thanks for the laugh, says Jim in St. Pete's. I get where you're going with that one. Thanks for that. And all right, well, let's hear what Les has to say in Brooksville. Hi, Les.
Hey, guy. Great show, as always. I was, in 04, we missed Charlie by a dime. It was projected to go right up U.S. 19 through St. Pete, and then it just took a juke step and went right. And I was watching the radar when it happened. I said, this doggone tank's turning. And it did. And it went across the street, and I think it came out in Vero Beach. And then in 05, of course, there was Katrina. And I was a FEMA volunteer. And while picking up my equipment in Houston, seeing all the displaced people at the Astrodome, we flew back at 30,000 feet. We flew over the Mississippi Delta. And I could see where the eye wall went. At 30,000 feet, it's kind of clear, you know. And you heard all these stories about, the people and, the Ninth Ward and all that. Well, let me tell you something. The people in southeast Louisiana lost it all. I mean, there were houses that were moved, and there were communities that were just flattened. There was nothing there. A couple of kid toys, and it was awful. And for all the climate deniers out there, these people aren't scientists. You know, they're capitalist pigs, in my opinion. You know, they don't understand science. They probably never took science in school. All they think about is the money, and the money really comes from petroleum, and petroleum is adding to the carbon dioxide. And if you look at the ice core samples, going back centuries, it's not rocket science.
All right. Thanks so much for that, Les. I appreciate that call. Melissa?
Thank you for your volunteer service in FEMA. You actually just reminded me of something when you talked about school and learning about this. The reason I'm passionate is because I learned about it from a college professor. But I was one of the other points in the Washington Post article, they talked about how last month Republican-controlled state legislature in Florida approved bills allowing any citizen to challenge textbooks and instructional materials, including those that teach the science of evolution and global warming. Now, I find that very disheartening. I think the science should be left to the scientists, and the scientists are overwhelmingly telling us that climate change is real, that humans are causing it, and that we can make a difference. We can change it. We can reduce the impact. So that is, I find that very disheartening. One other thing I wanted to bring up, I know we talked a little bit about Southeast Florida, and we're talking a lot about hurricanes, and I think we all remember, those of us who were here, we remember those moments when we were watching Charlie and we were watching Katrina, and just the terror that you feel with those things coming in. So I think it's absolutely important to be prepared, and having Florida counties work together, specifically Tampa Bay counties working together in a West Coast Climate Compact, I think can be a huge part of that solution. And we are already seeing leadership from people in Tampa City Council and Pinellas County who are looking at creating a West Coast Climate Compact. My good friend Susan Glickman is working on that, and so I'd encourage you to contact the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy to learn more about that.
All right, thanks, Melissa. And one last email I want to read quickly. This Marcia says, thanks, Melissa, for the great information. Please invite her and your listeners listeners to our meeting this Wednesday at 6:30 at the Seminole Heights Public Library. Our guest speaker will be Colin Rice from Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. We'll continue this discussion on local threats and actions we can take. Find us on Meetup and Facebook. Marsha Biggs, Executive Committee of the Suncoast Sierra Club. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Marsha.
And I want to thank Melissa for coming on WMNS Midpoint. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Melissa Baldwin is the founder of Chase Media Services. It's a communications company that specializes in sustainability and climate change. I want to thank everybody who called, emailed, and texted today. And if you're still on hold, or if you'd like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, call me at 813-238-8001, extension 114, and I'll play your message next show. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news. You can join us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WMNF News. Thanks to our engineer, Alvaro Montealegre. Welcome back, Alvaro. And to our phone answerer, Frank Knox. And thanks also to Max. I'm Sean Canaan, the host of WMNF News Midpoint Monday, tomorrow at noon. Your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned now for Craig Kopp in executive session. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. Thanks for listening.